place but me and her. Well, it must be a holiday. There's nobody around. She studies me closely as I sit down.
Hello, folks. We were just talking about how wonderful that was to have Bob Dylan in the background. That was perfect music for our guest. We are so honored today to have Larry Christ. Christ, I'm sorry. I forgot to ask before we came on. Larry Christ, who wrote a report called Broken Systems, Broken Promises, and we are going to do a deep dive into that today on the 4-H show. So my name is Amy Hornblass, and I am co-hosting with Jerry Procaccini, and this is the 4-H show. 4-H's stand for health, harmony, happiness, and humor. And so we are deep diving into all sorts of health issues lately. And I just want to remind listeners that you are listening to WMRWLP, broadcasting from Warren, Vermont, at 94.5 FM. You can also find us streaming online at WMRW.org. And let me remind you that the following program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork. And we are so fortunate to be underwritten by a couple of underwriters. Our sponsors include Super Simple Foods, offering homemade soups and fresh bread daily. You can now find Super Simple Foods at the Mad River Car Wash at 124 Findlers Green in Waitsfield from Wednesdays to Saturday, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. We also have Whippletree Designs, and they have Vermont souvenir apparel for all ages. Whippletree Designs is located at Mad River Green Shopping Center in Waitsfield. You can reach Whippletree Designs by calling 802-496-9694 or follow them on Instagram under Whippletree Designs. All right, so we have Larry Christ from Burlington here today, who has written a really incredible report, or co-wrote along with a team. He's going to explain how this report came together. It's a very good deep dive into the DCF, Department of Children and Families system, especially pertaining to their substantiation of child abuse internal workings. And after several years of providing legal support to families going through that system, they have uncovered some very, very serious problems with that system. And so we just want to, of course, remind people that we understand that Vermonters are very, very caring of children. We love families here in Vermont, and we all would love to support families the best we can. And there are so many well-meaning people inside the system doing all they can within this broken system to try to do their best to protect families. And we also have, you know, people who have inexperience. We have sort of a lack of wisdom going on. And so the purpose of this show is to raise awareness so that we can get to a closer place of healing. And then to also really tease apart parental rights versus state rights, which is actually a theme here on the 4-H show. We've been covering that for a few weeks, where parental rights and state rights intervene, and nothing could be more parental rights centered than actual parents with born children they've been raising, and then the state intervening and removing those children. That is an incredible power. So we are really honored to have people like Larry in our state who are helping us keep an eye on what is going on behind the DCF curtain here. Thank you for joining us, Larry.
Well, thank you very much, Amy, for taking on this issue, because it is a critical issue, even though most people are really unaware of it.
Yeah, unless you're part of the system. And it's interesting, the myths that are out there too about it, and that we were talking before we came on the show, how the system in its modality and its operation has sort of changed too over the last 20 years. So people may have had experience long ago and don't realize what's happening inside now, and things like that. Yeah, so you wrote this 49-page report, or helped to write, Broken Systems, Broken Promises. And you start out by saying, the substantiation project was designed to test one of the most significant powers granted to the state government to substantiate abuse or neglect. And in conducting the study such as this, you found that the ability to intervene in the relationship between children and their parents, especially to separate them, is not necessarily being done fairly.
That is what we found, much to our chagrin. Just to sort of backfill with the listening audience, the state has, there are a number of significant powers that the state has. The state can incarcerate you, the state can take your children away. But those are done by a judge or a jury in court. The third significant power is the state can place any one of us on a child abuse registry, and it's called the Child Protection Registry. There is no court involved with that, and there is no judge involved. That is purely an administrative decision that's carried out by the Department for Children and Families. And that system, it's important to realize a couple things. The first thing is there are children in this state who are abused and are neglected. There is no question about that, and we have to have a child protection system that addresses those issues. At the same time, there is no oversight of the system that we've created. Realistically, there is virtually no oversight of this system. So it's a state agency that's been given a tremendous responsibility, a huge amount of pressure, but very little oversight to help them make sure they stay within the guardrails of the law, the Constitution, and what's fair and just, and how to protect children in that arena. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult job. The people mm-hmm. who work in that department have one of the most difficult jobs in state government. They have one of those difficult jobs, period.
Absolutely.
But this is a systems problem. It's not a people problem. But the reality is that if the system is hurting people, then it becomes a people problem. And especially if it's hurting children and it's hurting their parents at the same time. And what our project was designed to do was to see, does this system work well? Does it protect children? Does it support families? And does it protect families that are wrongly accused? I hoped when we embarked upon this 2.5 years ago, we decided to take the first 15 appeals that came to us. No pre-screening, no saying, no, this case we don't want to handle, this other case we do want to handle. We said the first 15 cases that come to us, we will take those cases. And I really hoped that we would lose every one of those appeals.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we lost the appeals, it meant the system was working.
Mm-hmm. And they had come to the proper judgment.
They had come to the proper judgment and they had done it the proper way.
Mm-hmm.
What we found at the end of the 15 appeals was that all 15 had been overturned. We didn't lose any of them.
Mm.
And I went back to our board and said, I think there's a flaw in our pilot project here because no one wins all the cases.
Yeah.
So let's take 5 more.
Mm-hmm.
And then we took 5 more. And then we took 5 more because we kept winning them all.
Right.
And to date, we have won. And as I mentioned before the show, I think it's now 27. We've won 27 cases out of 27 cases.
Wow.
That only happens if a system is broken. That's mm-hmm. the only way that you can win every case is if a system is broken. Or, conversely, it's how you lose every case if you don't have proper representation.
Right. So that was the key point, was what made the difference.
That is the key point. That what we found is that the average person can't defend themselves with regard to these allegations. They
mm-hmm.
just can't. The systems are too complex. The mm-hmm. laws are too complex. And we spent a lot of time trying to learn how to do this. And we have also, as part of this project, we have tried to provide people with support so that they could defend themselves. And what we found was none of them could. We needed to come back in and intervene in each instance because the average person simply doesn't know how to do this.
Yeah, how to represent themselves.
Exactly.
In this kind of a legal situation where the legal terms change even over, you know, in different contexts.
And the laws are complex and, mm-hmm. and frankly, the laws are very difficult to understand in mm-hmm. some situations. I mean, what many people don't understand in Vermont is that if you have a child who is injured and a physician looks at the injury and says, well, this is suspicious, and the parent doesn't know how the child got that injury, including just bruises, doesn't know how a child got the bruises, essentially the state can say, you're responsible for the child. And since the child has the bruises and you have no explanation for them, you're the person who's held responsible for those bruises.
And it's assumed to be abuse.
It's assumed to be abuse, and you go on the registry. And when you go on the Child Protection Registry, what it means is that if you are employed in any job that relates to children or children's services, a teacher, a therapist, a child care worker, a medical professional, you can't, in most cases, keep your job. And if you are a licensed professional, you are likely to lose your license. So you can spend your academic career, go to graduate school, go through the licensing process and testing, and then have it all go away because you were placed on the Child Protection Registry. And the way people are placed on that registry is probably the most egregious. It's not by a hearing, it's not by a judge or a court, it's by a DCF investigator who does it, who gets a report, does an investigation, meets with their supervisor, and those two people make the decision as to whether you go on the Child Protection Registry or not. And after that, it's up to you to appeal and get yourself off.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. A kind of behind closed doors process with...
It's very much a behind closed doors process. Now, there is an appeal mechanism. There are two appeal mechanisms. One is an administrative review by DCF.
So it's like an internal.
Right, it's an internal. They are independent contractors hired by DCF. Oh. However, they are supervised by DCF. They are paid by DCF. And the training that they get largely is from DCF and the direction, but they are supposed to make independent decisions. Mm. The problem is that in state law, we have two standards of proof, which makes no sense at all at this point in time. At the DCF level, it's whether a reasonable person thinks that you committed child abuse based on the information that DCF has gotten. Not evidence, not witnesses, not anything else, simply the information that they have. And the story that I told you before we came on the air is we all have very good friends, and we choose our friends carefully. And I think pretty much we can say that our friends are reasonable people. But I've never been in a gathering of my friends who are reasonable people and found everyone agreed.
Right.
But that's the standard that DCF uses.
Which is so arbitrary, just depending on the person.
Absolutely, it is arbitrary. And it's even more arbitrary when you look at the fact that these initial substantiations are done in 12 different district offices that operate in different ways. They have a set of standards to follow, but you have hundreds and hundreds of people involved in this scattered all over the state. So you can be substantiated in St. Johnsbury and maybe not in Bennington for exactly the same action. That's not a state system. It's not a system that works well. And there at this juncture really is very little centralization of the reviews. Some cases are reviewed by a smaller group of people within DCF, but that's a real minority of the cases. So it's an independent decision made by people who may be well trained, may be really good at their jobs, or they may not be so well trained and they may not be so good at their jobs. You're substantiated. That's it. You know, so then you get to go to this administrative review, but the standard of proof is the same. Would a reasonable person looking at this information decide you abused the child or not? And you have to, you're given limited information. The information you are given is maybe a 10 or 12 page document with half of it blacked out.
Yeah, I found that really interesting. You do a really good job in the report of breaking down, you know, these problems and what they look like. And that is a very serious one. You're going to defend yourself against, you know, the substantiation, and you can't even see the evidence against you. And in some cases, they didn't even present the evidence at all. You know, some things were actually withheld from them altogether, like the shenanigans going on as far as the legal terms changing and the information changing over time. It, no wonder just a common person without the legal training couldn't do it.
It is very hard, because the usual response when an individual tries to do that themselves is say, I didn't do it.
Right. I'll just tell the truth.
Right.
All I have to do is tell the truth.
I didn't do it. And frankly, I've only been involved in one of these cases where that actually worked. And because it turned out that the investigator and the supervisor put no information into the report to support their decision.
So there wasn't even information, let alone evidence.
Exactly.
And so folks, we're talking about, in most cases when you go to court, there needs to be evidence of a crime or a misdeed. But in this case, for DCF, it's just evidence. And evidence is just whatever information, information, which is whatever information they've gathered from whomever they've gathered it from.
And it can be selective. There can be, say, 10 witnesses and only two of them are interviewed. The other eight would have said something else. And that's what our project discovered, because we would go and talk to all 10, not the two that just the department talked to.
And actually do a full investigation to gather your evidence to present in court.
So that's the first appeal, which is already the, I hate to describe it as the playing field, but the playing field for those appeals is already very tilted. Mm-hmm. You don't get to see all the information, even to the extent that your own children's names are blacked out. Their initials will be there, but if you have children with the same, more than one child with the same initials, you really have to scratch your head sometime to figure out what is being alleged here and what and what child.
So it's under like a confidentiality?
Highly confidential, those files.
From your own self.
From yourself, exactly. Wow. And that's because the system was designed decades ago when no one from the public, no employer, could see the registry.
Right, so maybe we should explain that, right?
So the registry was created about 30 years ago, or thereabouts, and the federal government required states to maintain a registry of child abuse. And that was so that the federal government would have a sense of how rampant is child abuse in the country, because they had no idea at the time. So each state was required to do this. And at the same time, each state, using Vermont specifically, issued licenses. So a child care license, a foster care license, those were state licenses, and those were people who were engaged in doing work for the state. The state agency at the time, called SRS, was the only entity that could look at the registry, because they didn't want to give a license to someone whom they thought maybe had abused.
Understanding that it wasn't a conviction, but it was just a red flag. I remember it was sort of like a red flag
system.
That's
what it was. It was a red flag system. Because none of us are entitled to a state license. We're all entitled to apply if we want, but the state doesn't have to give us a license if it doesn't want to. And so that's what the registry was used for. And then about 25 years ago, or thereabouts, 20 to 25 years ago, the legislature, in its wisdom, said, wait a minute, employers should be able to see this registry as well. Schools, child care facilities,
nursing homes,
any group of entities that had anything to do with children or children's services, including, in fact, even today, companies that have contracts to do data batching for a child care center. You would think, well, wait a minute, these are people don't even work for that center. Or say the University of Vermont, when it had a child care program on campus. If you applied for a custodian's job at UVM in the med school and you were on the registry,
you couldn't even do that.
They could hire you. They can hire you. However, they have to get their insurance company's permission. I have yet to see an insurance company that will agree to insure someone who is on a child abuse registry.
Wow.
That's just not realistic.
So that's where employers...
So now we have this system where the protections in the system for people, what it took to be substantiated, what it took in appeals, are all antiquated. they were not designed for a system where now you have liberty interests and you have property rights. So a lot of people don't understand that if you wind up on the registry and say you have three or four children in school, young children, you can't go on field trips.
Right. You can't volunteer to go on the bus. And
you can't be a volunteer. You can't do any of those things. So we have worked with people that have multiple children in school who've never been able to participate in their children's activities. And then we've worked with their cases and found that, no, these people shouldn't have been on the registry to begin with. But all those years are lost.
Right.
And the other piece is that children are frequently removed as part of the system where the investigation determines whether the children are at risk or not. That happens on the front end of cases. The substantiation process can sometimes take 2 years to resolve. So in theory, your children can be removed because there's a corresponding family court case that's based on the same information.
Wow.
You have two different processes happening. You have a court process where your children can be removed. You have a substantiation process where you are put on a registry, but the two aren't connected. So if the court decides that these events didn't happen, you can still be substantiated by DCF. And that process still continues unless you have an advocate who knows, wait a minute, there was a court case going on. Let's go back and get the court records which say this abuse never happened. And now we present that in the substantiation case.
Get the hearing, and all, which it looked like from the report, it's really difficult to even get this, process to move.
Yes, it's difficult to get the process to move. And the time frames in which you are allowed to appeal have really reached the point where they're absurd now. And now this is not DCF's fault. This is the law. The statute says that you have 14 days within which to appeal from the date that, and it's a little unclear, the date the letter is dated or the postmark on it. It's still unclear as to which date that can be. And that was okay when you weren't going to lose your job because of it.
Right.
You just, you know, weren't going to be able to get a state license. Well, now, as we all know, the old adage, I say 5 years ago, of you mail a letter in Vermont on Monday and it's guaranteed to get someplace on Tuesday. Well, now it might be Tuesday the next week.
Right.
So in theory, you can lose 3, 4, 5 days of your appeal process, and you have to have your appeal into DCF within that 14, not postmarked. It has to be in their hands within the 14 days.
Wow.
That's the way it reads.
And with, you know, remote workers and lockdowns and, you know, things are just getting, things could sit in inboxes or outboxes for weeks.
Plus, in many cases, you're getting this notice right after your children have been removed.
Yeah.
You're going through unbelievable trauma and
the
confusion.
I think people are forgetting the
And you're having to deal with family court all at the same time. And then there's this letter that says if you don't respond within 14 days.
Right, and usually the date is only a few days from when you've gotten it.
And
so
there have been some instances where the dates were a week and a half, you know, because of holidays, because of the way it was posted. Plus, there is a further complication, which this project uncovered, which is that DCF has the law as to when they're supposed to send these letters. They have policies and they have practices about how the letters get sent. DCF does not have, nor has it ever had, a system that verifies that the letter was actually mailed.
Wow.
So there are people on the registry who were never notified.
Wow, just slipped through the cracks. I mean, human error.
Exactly. Or it's sometimes it's, you can have, I mean, think of it this way. You can have employees who, for a variety of reasons, don't do their job. Now, most state employees, and I'm a retired state employee, most state employees bend over backwards to try to serve the public. But we all know in every organization you have people. So all you need is one person who decides that they're just not going to mail these letters. And you're never notified again.
So you miss that window.
You miss the window. Not only the window, you miss knowing that you have been substantiated. So you can go, and we've had a couple of cases, years, and then you apply for jobs. In one of the cases we refer to, a medical person, highly skilled, highly experienced, kept applying for different jobs, and kept getting turned down.
And they don't tell you, the employers?
No, they don't tell
you. Oh, wow.
She only found out because after the last time she contacted the employer, and she said, please tell me what the problem is.
Uh-huh.
I have more experience than you're asking for.
Yeah.
And they said, you're on the Child Protection Registry.
Wow.
And that was the first time she had any knowledge of mm-hmm. being on the registry. And we have since found several other people that have come to us, and we've never advertised this,
mm-hmm.
because potentially there might only be the three we've encountered.
Mm-hmm.
There might be 30.
Mm-hmm.
There might be 300. Of the 25,000 people on the registry today,
25,000.
There might be 3,000 who never got the letter.
Yeah.
And the other issue that happens here is that the letter is mailed by law to the last known address. But when you're investigated by DCF, you aren't told that that's how you're going to be notified.
Mm-hmm.
So if the investigation takes 2 or 3 months, you may have moved.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that you're supposed to give them your address. So the letter goes to your old address and then gets sent back.
Mm-hmm.
Or it goes to the old address and the people at the old address just take it and throw it away because
right.
they don't know where you are or they don't even know who you are. So you have this system where you can lose your children through this process. You can lose your job and you can lose your ability to volunteer, be around children. You can also lose your certification as a
mm-hmm.
professional. And it's all based on maybe someone mailed a letter to you.
Mm-hmm. And some information.
And some information.
That you don't even get to see totally.
And there's no guarantee that the letter was actually mailed.
Wow.
Because there's no record of mm-hmm. it being mailed by John Doe or Jane Smith on such and such a day, and here's the signature showing that it was mailed.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like that.
Okay, and so the system was set up just to be a behind-the-doors red flag system.
Absolutely.
For internal government workings. Then it was shared with employers.
Right.
And then it's even broader. You were saying, in 2014 that some serious
in 2014, the landscape changed through the tragic death of two children. I mean, the death of a child is tragic no matter what.
Right.
In this instance, these were particularly egregious deaths.
Okay.
And the state's reaction, which is normal and is common
right.
around the country.
To overreact.
It is to overreact.
Yeah.
And so what it did was it put huge pressure on to people who work in the child protection arena to make sure that no child got harmed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like asking the police department to make sure that no one experiences crime.
Right.
And
it's
can't
impossible.
Be done.
They're not there before the fact.
Yes. The only place that happens
mm-hmm.
is in well-run authoritarian countries.
Okay.
That's it. You
yeah.
know, the crime rate is relatively low because it's an authoritarian system.
Uh-huh.
And whereas we don't live in an authoritarian system.
Yeah.
But what happened was that was the reaction. And so workers were put under a huge amount of pressure. And you can go back and look at the data. The rate of children coming into state custody skyrocketed.
Right. Because
from that point on.
I found that interesting because before that I was working in domestic violence for over a decade and working with survivors of domestic violence and children who had witnessed domestic violence. And the way that the state seemed to be operating, well, it was just like you said, each office was different. You know, Newport's office handled things different from Morrisville's office, and, you know, we got used to that. But it seemed to be pretty hands-off. It was almost impossible to get the state to intervene in what seemed like pretty serious cases,
no.
You know, where we were begging, the victims were begging, please protect my children, and we couldn't get protection. So when I started to hear these stories, you know, since 2014 now, of people, you know, having their children removed for witnessing domestic violence, which, you know, was not the case before, and we know that that can discourage victims from coming forward for help. So I was really surprised yeah. about this whole change in the system and where that came from. And it, so it's real. It really happened.
Yes, it is real. And I think that I want to make sure that listeners understand, though, that it's real in two different directions. It is real that people who have not abused children are not only accused of it, but they are convicted of it without ever being in a courtroom.
Wow.
At the same time, and that happens because the investigative process is based on a set of laws that don't work anymore. Mm-hmm. Consequently, the investigators are not necessarily really good at their job, mm-hmm. which means that they will err on the side of caution mm-hmm. and say, yes, I'm not sure what happened here, but I think we probably should say that this looks like it could be abuse. Well, that's all they have to say, and then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if you're not good at investigating mm-hmm. so that you wind up investigating and substantiating the wrong people, you are probably not good at identifying the right people who should be substantiated.
Right.
And one of the things that I was most struck by through our project is that a person could walk through our door and say, here's my case, take it. And I could do the investigation and I could see that they did it.
Mm-hmm.
When DCF really didn't have the evidence that they did it. And I didn't want to be in that position.
Uh-huh.
And I can say with a straight face and a good conscience, I think at this point, that every one of the 26 or 27 cases we have won, there was no evidence that these people did what it was they were charged with doing.
Hmm.
But at the same time, someone with enough money to mm-hmm. hire a very good lawyer who did abuse children has a very good chance of getting off without being substantiated.
Right, because if the system's so broken, you just call
yes.
out any one of these fumblings that seem to happen that are clearly breaking the law in the case and expose those.
And that's it.
You know, on a technicality, because there are so many mistakes being made.
Or just raising a legitimate question.
Right.
That's there.
That a reasonable person could...
yes. And so our goal was to identify the problems in the system and then present this so that the state can fix the system and it can work properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can protect children and protect families. Because what many people forget is that it is the department for children and families.
Right.
And somehow the and families gets lost in this process. And I also, as a parent of three, now not children anymore, but mm-hmm. they're always going to be my children, I want to make sure that all children in Vermont are cared for and protected. And I want to make sure that parents are able to raise their children without the state interfering every time there is a bruise, every time there is, you know, any number of things. And I think that if people want a real understanding of what we found with this project, 47 pages sounds like a lot. But as one reader told me, it's a page turner.
Oh, it is.
Once you start reading it, you don't want to stop. It's readily accessible by going to www.vtprc.org. You will see our initial report from 2018, which is much longer. It's 117 pages. And you will see Broken System, Broken Promises. Both of those reports are there, and they're easily accessible.
Can you repeat that website again?
Sure. It's www.v as in Victor, T as in Tom, P as in Paul, R as in Romeo, C as in Charlie.org. So,
and what does that stand for? What's your organization?
It's the Vermont Parent Representation Center, Incorporated.
And how did that get started?
It was started about 12 years ago, primarily by three individuals who had been professionals in the child welfare system and who recognized that the system was moving in a direction that was not supporting families.
Mm-hmm.
It was moving in a direction where people were being identified as abusers who weren't. Mm-hmm. And no one knew how to get them out of the system. So the organization originally, and that's the reason it's called Representation Center, initially it did provide legal representation to parents and had a phenomenal success rate.
Mm-hmm.
It would take cases early on before they went to family court and divert the families from family court. And in 68 to 72% of the cases, the families kept their children and
wow.
did well.
Wow.
Then it decided, okay, if we team a lawyer and a social worker, someone who understands social services, together working with these families, they'll get the legal representation they need, and they'll also get the access to the services in mm-hmm. navigating the system.
Yeah.
that was the first pilot project, and that's the one that had this success rate of over 70%. Mm-hmm. The second pilot project that VPRC did was it provided the same services, but worked with a more difficult population. Mm-hmm. Women who were pregnant and or had very young children and who were involved with substance abuse, mm-hmm. which was considered one of the most difficult categories to work with. Teaming a lawyer with social services people, the same outcomes.
Wow.
It's
amazing.
It is amazing. And you would think that the system we have in place today, where if someone is brought to family court, they get a public defender and they, you know, have DCF to work with. It doesn't work the same way, no. Unfortunately, because the public defenders have their own problems in many instances. That system does. Mm-hmm. On average, they aren't paid enough. Mm-hmm. On average, they don't have the skills to do the investigations that need to be done, and they don't have the resources to investigate.
Right, to do their own.
And they don't have the time. They simply can't put the time in that needs to be put into these categories. That is really, in many ways, not just a disservice to the families and to the children, it's a disservice to DCF. Mm-hmm. Because DCF needs some counterbalance. DCF needs some entity who will push back against DCF to say, make sure you're doing a good job, because if you aren't, we're going to find the evidence and we're going to win these cases. That doesn't happen in these instances for a number of reasons. First of all, as I said, the average public defender doesn't have the resources or the time, and in many cases doesn't have the skills to do that. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that the family court system is completely confidential. You cannot talk about a family court case in any detail with any identifiers. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you are subject to a fine, and if you're a professional, you can lose your ability to practice law by talking about the specifics. So you have a closed DCF investigation system for substantiations and a closed child in need of services family court system without any real oversight on either end.
Right. In isolation, yeah. You know, nothing healthy happens usually.
No, there's the idea of, you know, sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Exactly.
Well, there is no
fresh air.
Yeah, there is no sunshine or fresh air in these systems. They mm-hmm. are closed systems. And that's why it took this tiny, and we really are a tiny nonprofit, to be able to do this research, because mm-hmm. we were the only entities who were willing to put the time in, who were able to find enough donors to keep our doors open so that we could do this work, mm-hmm. and who don't receive government money. Because once you receive government money, you can't speak truth to power. You can't do that.
Right.
Because your money is at stake. If you're too good at your job, you won't be in your job very long. And that's been one of the big differences. By having this really small nonprofit available to do this work and willing to do it, with a board of directors willing to put in the time and volunteers, mm-hmm. we've been able to do the work that we've done. And this is not focused to point fingers at people. We look at systems. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in our reports do we identify specific people mm-hmm. and say it's this person's fault or that person's fault. It's the systems.
Well, systems allow people to anonymously
and
partake.
Also force people to mm-hmm. participate.
Right. Well, right. People who, right.
In order
to stay in that system and do the good work you're trying to do,
you have to do things that you know aren't right. Mm-hmm. But that's the way the system is set up. And there has really not been the kind of intensive review of the laws to change them so that the people in the system can do the right job, the system can get the right outcomes that it wants, and the public can trust the system.
Right.
You know, that's
There's
a huge
a
piece of this.
There's a distrust.
There's a huge distrust.
And a lot of mythology and things.
Right. And not all of it is merited, mm-hmm. but we now know from these reports that a lot of it is merited.
Right.
And the question is, are we ready as Vermonters to fix these systems? Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about one other thing, because people have said, well, Larry, you've done less than 30 of these cases, and yet every year there are 700 to 900 or 1,000 substantiations each year. So it's about 900 every year. We only did a handful from a two and a half year window. However, just recently, the state of Pennsylvania decided to go back and look at its system. Now, they didn't do the deep dive case by case the way we've done in Vermont, where we can actually point to why the mistakes were made and where they were made. They just looked at the outcomes. And what they found is when the state system made its decisions about appeals, no one won. No one won. This is Pennsylvania. This is a big state. Mm-hmm. However, when the person knew that they could go to a court for the same appeal, the courts ruled in favor of the people 90% of the time.
Wow.
And what that has shown me is...
It's two opposite outcomes.
Two opposite outcomes.
Same cases.
And it's the two opposite outcomes that we found in Vermont.
Right.
Using a smaller number of cases, of course, but doing the deep dive, because mm-hmm. our report really breaks down each of the cases and why the substantiation was wrong.
And you were able to see the patterns, like you were saying.
Absolutely.
That other lawyers don't necessarily
no
get
one
that
has
volume.
Been able to see, to our knowledge, no one has been able to see those patterns before, because mm-hmm. first of all, it costs so much if you hire a private attorney that there are very few attorneys who are versed in this. There are attorneys who will tell you they are, mm-hmm. but when you look at their track records, they haven't won many cases of these appeals. But part of that also is that if there is no market to purchase your services, you don't develop the skills.
Right.
And we wound up in a situation where we put a huge focus on this, and we were able to take each case and say, okay, here are all the things that happen. Now, how does that compare to the next case and the next case? And then we saw the patterns. Mm-hmm. We saw the inability to really thoroughly investigate. We saw how information was presented in a damning way, but when you looked at the source of the information, it was taken out of context.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the best examples I have is an example of a situation where there was a teenager involved, substantiation occurred of the parent, of a non-parent, and all based on a statement by the teenager that the teenager knew this was wrong when it was happening. What was left out was why the teenager knew it was wrong, because they were doing the actions themselves. But that's not what was put into the reports.
Right.
Now, you can say, okay, was that intentional? Was it not intentional? We'll never know, right. But there was no check and balance. There
right.
was no one who went back to look at the videotapes of the interviews. And in many cases, as we have also found, the videotapes don't exist anymore.
Right, the equipment is faulty. I really like your suggestion of making it the onus of the responsibility of working equipment and, you know, and usable
right.
recordings
yes.
to be put on DCF, because it seems like in almost all the cases it was, you know, the tape didn't work or it was non-existent. Well, why not fix
right.
the machine after this many cases where this has happened?
And in cases where the recordings were available, what you saw was what happened in the recording was not what was put in the report.
Wow.
And that, to me...
So if the only evidence you have is...
Yes. And especially when you think about the reason for these recordings isn't just to protect people.
Mm-hmm.
It's because these are often young children.
Yeah.
You don't want to put them through repeated revisions of a traumatic experience. So you do it once, you do it properly, and you record it. And
mm-hmm.
then you don't have to put the kids through it again. But when they're not available any longer, and the state still goes forward, because see, here's the key. If you, as an example, were substantiated, and you had your first appeal and you lost it, and then you went to the Human Services Board, you wouldn't know to say in the discovery phase, I want copies of those recordings.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't know to do that.
Right.
And
if you don't,
and if you
it.
Don't, then you never learn that there aren't any recordings or that the recording said something different than what it was reported the recording said.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a, like I said, this is a systems problem, and all of these things can be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just happy that, not happy, I'm happy that we were able to identify them. I'm
mm-hmm.
not happy of what we found.
Right.
And I'm not happy for the families that have gone through this process.
Right.
So, you know, if I could, I'd like to just sort of touch very quickly on the report in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that the system we use today was not designed for its current use. We're trying to use a tool that no longer applies.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't, and it needs to be changed. The misdesignation has real-world consequences. when somebody guesses whether abuse or neglect occurred, that's a terrible guess.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter which way they guess. It's a terrible guess.
Right, either way.
People need to base their decisions on evidence, and we don't do that now. There's a presumption of guilt that if a parent can't show how a child was injured, they must be guilty.
I just think of all the things kids do all day and all the different...
I think of one of my children in particular who made multiple trips for medical attention.
To the dog, yeah.
Because he was a risk taker from a young age. The system has no meaningful oversight, and that's where the legislature has to step in this legislative session. Mm-hmm. It needs to change the laws, and it needs to figure out how to provide oversight, because DCF deserves that. They deserve to have oversight. We all need oversight in our work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other thing is, we have a child protection registry now that has about, because no one knows for sure, about 25,000 names on it. That has lost all purpose relative to public safety, which is what it was supposed to help us with, and also to give us a sense of how much abuse occurs. Because if every appeal turns out that the substantiation was wrong, then how many of these 25,000 people should not be on the registry?
Right.
And when you just statistically, and remember, statistics lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
statistically,
they do.
One in every 26 Vermonters is on the registry.
I was wondering how to put that number in context. So one in every 26 Vermonters is on this registry.
Now, we know that is a statistical number because a lot of the people on the registry have died.
Oh.
People have come on and come off. So
moved.
But you can't get off the registry unless you seek expungement and go through the same appeal process that I just described.
Wow.
The same flawed appeal process.
Mm-hmm.
So
and would probably need legal representation based on your findings
if you don't have good representation, mm-hmm. you will not be successful. You are not likely to be successful.
Right.
And then you wait another year or 2 years or however many years it is, because it's different with each person, before you can apply again. Mm-hmm. So in theory, you could go on the registry as an 18-year-old or even a 16-year-old and be there all your life.
Yeah, I saw a youth offender you talk about.
There have
who
been.
Was, it looked like it was a couple of years.
There have been several.
A minor alleged to have engaged in improper actions with a child a year younger. He or she was substantiated by the department review and later denied expungement. So he asked to be taken off the list and was refused, and upon appeal to the Human Services Board, it was determined that during the expungement appeal, the department improperly accessed juvenile court records and utilized them for substantiation. So rather than confirm or deny their improprieties, the department refused for 12 months to respond to the petitioner and the HSB's, the board's, request for discovery. As a result, the board overturned the substantiation, which made the issue of expungement moot. So this was something else. So this took 43 months. Minor. Yeah. And I've worked in schools, and I've worked with domestic violence survivors, and I've worked with kids who have this label.
Yeah.
And boy, I mean, everything in their life changes. They're treated differently in school, because even though it's somewhat confidential, there's caseworkers who know.
Absolutely.
And they need to protect the other kids. I mean, who knows what this child's... youth's life became like for that time,
they can't apply for summer jobs.
Yeah,
because most
or
summer
be around
jobs,
siblings.
Well, most well, usually they can be around siblings.
Okay.
Excuse me, but most teenagers, their summer jobs have to do with summer activities with youth.
Yeah,
can't do it.
Wow.
So
refuse to respond. You know, so we have this department that won't even answer
and
us.
And there's where the lack of oversight comes in.
Yeah,
because there are elements in the department that believe that they do not have to answer to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't answer to anyone now.
Right. And no one makes them.
Part of our process was to try to hold them accountable and show there need to be checks and balances. Like for every system, there need to be checks and balances.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And the other fact that that the way that they which made the issue of expungement moot, right? Because they just dropped it. So that in their own system, they're not going to catch these cases where they've actually been caught red-handed, you know, like doing some shenanigans. And so their way of covering it up is just to drop the case. Yeah. So now they don't have these overturned cases lumping, you know,
piling
up.
That is correct. In this instance, it actually does show up in the Human Service Board report because the board had to take a decision. But in, I think, excuse me, in all of the other cases that went to the Human Services Board, there is no record of them.
Wow.
So no one can see, oh my goodness, look, there's a pattern here.
Right.
The department has done the following thing 15 times.
Right.
At what point does someone tell the department you have to stop doing it that way? The other issue that comes up here is you have to prove over and over and over again in these cases that the department did something that was wrong. As opposed to, example, the mailing of a letter.
Mm-hmm.
It was clearly decided early on, the Attorney General's office acknowledged that the department did not have a verification system. So the department agreed to make the substantiation go away and remove the person.
Instead of fixing the problem, though.
So you go, there's a victory. Okay, mm-hmm. The right thing came out, and now they won't do this again. Or when the next person comes along with this same problem, this is going to be automatic.
Right.
No. The next case that came along, the same thing. The person said, I never received a letter. We are now 9 months into hearings on this same issue, which the department acknowledged a little over a year ago. That
was their
it doesn't
mistake.
Have a verification system.
Mm-hmm.
They're now saying, well, we have a law, we have a policy, we have a procedure. Well, great, but you have no proof.
Right. No evidence.
And they're hoping that the Human Services Board will rule, you know, one way or another on this. But it's like, wait a minute, folks.
Wow. And they've got nothing to lose.
They have nothing to lose in the process. And again, you can't blame this on individuals.
Mm-hmm.
This is a system protecting itself.
Right. And overworked and busy.
And overworked. And I will say this, could be organized differently.
Mm-hmm.
So that it could maximize the resources it has, focus on the families that really do need intervention, but not spend its time looking under every rock and at every bruise to say, we think this child might have been abused.
Yeah.
You can't go through life that way. I mean, children need, they need to have experiences where they live and they learn, and we've mm-hmm. all developed lots of bruises for lots of reasons.
Yeah. And parents need to be able to live and learn,
parents
too.
Need to be able to live a life where they're constantly, they're afraid to take children to the doctor because what happens if a report is made? And when a doctor gets a child, they look at the child and go, what happens if I don't report this?
So everybody,
it becomes, yes.
A silence.
And we've seen other countries and other systems that no longer exist, that's the way they operated. Everybody was afraid that somebody was going to report on them.
Right.
And
we know what that...
We have to come to grips with this. A starting point is here, and the legislature is going to have an opportunity this year to fix this. And I would encourage everyone who's listening to this program who has an interest here, it doesn't matter what your position is.
Mm-hmm.
Just let your legislators know this issue needs to be addressed.
Yes.
It does.
And we want to talk about that. We're going to stay for a few more minutes and get into to where this is going. We want to really make sure that this report makes a resounding boom and has some effect. So I just want to remind people that you are listening to WMRWLP from Warren, Vermont. We are at 94.5 FM and also streaming at WMRW.org. And we're going to keep going for a few more minutes. We are talking with Larry Crist, who wrote Broken Systems, Broken Promises. It's a report about DCF, the Department of Children and Families Abuse Registry. And they provided free legal services to the first, now 32 families who came through without any judgments or qualifications. And every one of the cases they have closed so far, they were able to overturn, just with some legal representation, overturn the substantiations of abuse. Yeah.
And I would also say that, I'm the principal author, but there were other people who contributed very heavily to this report, and those people are listed on the front end of the report, because without them, one person could not do this. It's mm-hmm. not possible for one person to do this. And we had some incredible people who have assisted us in many capacities. And without their help, this could not have come about.
Right.
It's, you know, it was an important project because we hoped we would fail, and we didn't. What we found was that the system failed. Now we have an opportunity in the state to fix it.
Yes.
And the question is, are we going to let this opportunity go by the wayside, or are we really going to do the things? And most of the things that are needed to do to fix this don't cost anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's not unlike our report from 2018, which identified something like 60 or 80 things that could be done, almost none of which cost money.
Wow.
They all could be fixed
yeah.
with administrative changes and changes in the law.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those are interlocked. The DCF can't change some things unless the law is changed.
Mm-hmm.
And other times they can make changes. But they're so engrossed in trying to do the day-to-day job that mm-hmm. looking out at the horizon to say, well, if we make these changes, our job's going to be much easier. Children
yeah.
will be better protected, better cared for. Families will be supported and more secure in their raising of children.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are possible. It's not like we're trying to go to the moon here.
Right.
You know, we already know we can go to the moon. We ought to be able to fix this, especially since we're not saying it's a lot of money. And in the areas where there is money that we need, the federal government is making money available. We just aren't availing ourselves of that money. So there's no reason not to fix
this at
this
point. There's no reason, except a lack of perspective. You know, people just aren't stepping back. And this report really helps people do that, get that perspective that maybe in the day-to-day themselves they can't see.
Yeah, 'cause the goal is to make a better system.
Mm-hmm.
That's the goal, and it should be the goal of everyone. It's not to
right.
do away with the system. It's not to defund DCF. It's not to do any of those things.
Right.
It's to make a better system so that children and families are cared for and supported and nurtured, and Vermont is a better place for families to live.
So what's the response that you're getting?
The response has been pretty amazing.
Great.
There is a lot of activity with some individuals in the legislature.
Good.
Who have decided that, you know, this
to
is something that this is something that needs to happen and can happen. There are a number of individual citizens groups that have come forward and said, we want to support these activities.
Good.
Interestingly enough, we've had great media support in the process. And that's a real challenge because this is a complex issue,
mm-hmm.
which a program such as this can delve into. Television can't do it quite so well. Print media has taken a real interest in this as well, and because they also have the time to be able to work through the issues.
Yeah.
And I would really encourage people to go to our website, to read the report, this report, and if they really want to understand the larger system, the larger child protection system, to look at our earlier report called Bending the Curve.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the best overview, I think, that exists of Vermont's child protection system. And it was written at the end of 2018, but very little has changed.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same system today that existed then. And all of those recommendations?
Right, that wasn't, yeah.
No, they weren't employed. They just weren't. So our feeling was, let's take a smaller bite. Let's just look at what we think is the most egregious piece of this, mm-hmm. which is the substantiation system.
Yeah.
And that's where this report came from. You know, and again, to summarize this, what the current law does and the policies do is it puts DCF employees in the position of being the police officer, the investigator, the judge, and the jury.
Right.
At the same time. And it's not fair.
Right. So constitutionally, where is this rubbing constitutionally?
Well, that's one of the issues that's being decided in Pennsylvania right now.
Mm-hmm.
As we said, the system we have today was employed, it was created when there weren't constitutional issues involved.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute that employers were able to have access, the field changed. There are constitutional liberty and due process requirements. And unless we get this system fixed, Vermont's going to be in the same situation that Pennsylvania's in now, with lawsuits.
Right. Your conclusion here in the report is really interesting. It really lays out some good solutions and then some repercussions if they don't
Yes, and none of us want to see scarce taxpayer dollars going to pay out settlements.
Right.
But that's what has to happen if systems don't change.
Well, right now we're funding foster care homes we don't need to be, or who knows what you know what time we're wasting, and then like you were saying, if we're not able to also see where there is real abuse, you know, if we're not able to discern the difference.
It's almost as though we have an assembly line now that everything on the assembly line just goes through.
Right.
No one scrutinizes it to see, are all the parts there? Mm-hmm. Are they in the right place?
Uh-huh.
And in some cases, as with the Human Services Board and the settlements, we will grab a defective part and throw it off to the side. But no one goes to count how many defective parts. And is it all that, you know, this toy soldier is missing the left leg in every one of them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go and see who's supposed to be putting the left leg on. There isn't any kind of review like that.
Right.
And this study was the first attempt to do that.
Yeah.
And frankly, it could be better, but I'm very proud of it.
No, I think it's incredible. And the personal stories there, I mean, you also break down the cases, which give really clear examples, I think, the real human side to it of what each specific situation is.
And people in Vermont will be hearing from some of these people directly.
Great.
Over the course of the next legislative session, because there are individuals here who don't want their identities known for very good reason, but there are other individuals who have said, no, I don't want this to happen to other people.
And that's the shaming, you know, there's a real silencing and isolation that's going on here, which the assembly line analogy is sort of interesting, because it's sort of like an assembly line with no care about whether the customers are satisfied or what, not having to sell the product. I mean, you know, it seems like most people you talk to are dissatisfied with the current DCF system and how it's working for one reason or another.
Yeah, and some of that is not necessarily legitimate, but what our project showed is a lot of it is legitimate.
Well, there's a real
stigma.
I mean, if you start hearing somebody say, yeah, I lost my kids and it wasn't my fault, it was nothing, you know, immediately, you know, the judgments start coming in, the questioning. But I have to say, I'm meeting more and more people who have lost their children and they're working jobs and things. I mean, they seem responsible. I'm not sure why, you know, so many parents are without their natural born children for whatever reason. And this is really explaining some of that.
Right. And the system is, the system itself is really a rigid system. And again, it's rigid because of the antiquated laws that we're working with, where someone will miss their 14 days, the window to appeal, and then they'll appeal to the Human Services Board. When you look at the case, you can see that they never should have been substantiated in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens at the Human Services Board is the argument is, did they file their appeal in time?
Oh, my goodness. So
and,
it gets down to
and if they didn't, automatically they lose their appeal right. It doesn't matter that you look at the evidence and see this never should have happened.
Right.
And even if you go to prison at this point, if you go to prison and you're serving, you know, a 30-year sentence, and halfway through that you have people who are able to prove that you didn't do this, you can go back to court and you can have that changed. In this system, you can't.
Ah, there is no.
Because your appeal rights are gone.
Wow.
And that's what they found, actually, in the Pennsylvania situation, where people, it was clear to the judges, this never should have happened. But the judges had to say, you can't come off the registry because you had to have appealed within a certain period of time.
Uh-huh.
Even though we know you're innocent.
And you also include in the report this really interesting graph that shows these four levels of let's see, the four levels of, by statute, the standards of proof. So the standards of proof that different states use to substantiate Department of Children and Families claims of child abuse. And I found it interesting that Vermont, Hawaii, Louisiana, and Oregon, we're the four who have the lowest standard.
Yes.
So it takes very little, just a reasonable person, like you were describing. And then the second highest, most other states have that second highest level, the preponderance of evidence. And then Pennsylvania, which you're talking about, actually goes up a step further to level 3.
It's clear and convincing.
Clear and convincing, yes. Which is actually more stringent. And so if they're running into problems, right? That could, and then I was really curious because there are 3 states, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and Wisconsin was the only one that has the highest level.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, is there any study looking at these different states and their different levels and comparing
No,
that?
that's a very good, that is a very good question.
Maybe we want to be like Wisconsin. Are they doing well with their high level?
Well, here's the dilemma there. The lower the standard, the theory is, and I think it's a false theory, the theory is the more abusers you catch.
Because you're just such a big net. You have such a big net, right.
The higher the standard, the fewer abusers you're going to catch because there are more protections. The converse of that, though, is the higher the standard, the more certain you are that the people you do convict or substantiate actually did it.
Right.
And in our system, what we have found is we don't know how else to do this. We've taken mm-hmm. every case that came to us. We won every case in one fashion or another. I don't know how else you go in to prove that, you know, the standards that we use just have no application today.
Right.
They just don't. And we need to address that.
I think it would really be interesting to look, you know, to look at that. Maybe we want a higher level.
Well, the preponderance of the evidence means that 51%, you need to have 51% of the evidence or greater.
Wow.
So you can actually measure things. You know, you can say, okay, there's this information and this information. When we look at the information, what evidence is behind it? Do we have 51% of the evidence in this case that shows that the person did what we think they did?
Mm-hmm.
That at least is something that's measurable. You can challenge that. The reason that the appeal to the Human Services Board is called de novo, to do over, it's new, a new appeal, it's a new hearing, is because you can't challenge reasonable person. Because you're a reasonable person and I'm a reasonable person. Well, some people might say I'm not a reasonable person, but for the sake of this discussion, we're both reasonable people.
Uh-huh.
So how is someone going to challenge your decision?
Right.
Because you're a reasonable person.
Right.
And
it's like
whereas,
a broken clock is right twice
well,
a day.
Exactly. And whereas with the preponderance of the evidence, at least you can say, okay, what's in this column and what's in this column, and let's balance it out.
The actual scales that we envision with justice.
Yes. So. And if we could make some changes with the registry itself, for as an example, you know, we have something in the state called risk of harm.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the statute. But risk of harm is very specific, except it has a couple of gray areas. Those gray areas have been blown out to such a degree now that almost anything a parent does with a child, in theory, places that child at risk of harm.
Mm-hmm.
You could say, a reasonable person says, as an example, that if you hang your clothes inside of your log home over your wood stove to dry in the wintertime because you don't have a dryer, you've placed your children at risk of harm. Because if those clothes happen to fall somehow and fall in or near the stove, they could catch fire and the fire could expand, and maybe your fire extinguisher doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can't get out of the house in time, and therefore your child would be seriously injured.
And now it's your fault. I mean,
now it's your fault.
As much as parents try to prevent any harm.
That may seem an extreme example.
Yeah.
It isn't.
No.
And, you know, that's the problem with having categories where you allow, where there isn't any oversight. So as an example, the Human Service Board has ruled that it can't be a projection of possible harm. You have to be able to show that there's a likelihood that harm would occur.
Mm-hmm.
But you could do that anyway. If you run a stop sign with a child in the car.
Is that an act of child abuse?
some people would say it is.
Yeah.
And other people would say it isn't. With a reasonable person standard, it's a coin toss.
Wow.
Okay. And I've seen these arguments made where, well, you know, there could be a truck that's coming from the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they have a stop sign too, but what if they run their stop sign while you're running your stop sign? The child could be seriously injured.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but what is the likelihood? So does that mean every time a parent runs a stop sign that if there's a child in the car?
Right.
And those may seem like extremes, but they aren't.
No.
So that's why this system needs the attention it does, because you can't be doing this to almost 1,000 people a year, every year. And we have no idea how many people were not substantiated who should have been.
Right.
Instead of the 900 or so who were substantiated, maybe there were 50 who really should have been, and none of them are in that category because those 50 knew enough and had the resources to hire somebody who could advocate for them.
Yeah, and defend themselves and deny.
Absolutely.
From the beginning.
Yes.
And not, admit, you know, anything.
And that's why
there were even cases you found where if they refused to work with DCF, just refusing to volunteer information and work with DCF, which would be, I would think, wise legal advice, to withhold your cards until you have to, actually makes you look suspicious. And
well, it does. And, that's why this is a system that really does need guidance and oversight and reform. It mm-hmm. just does. It's going to be hard no matter what the outcome, but right now it's failed. It is a failed system. There is no mechanism in place to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be up to the legislature this year. Mm-hmm. To say, yes, we want to address this, and we're going to address this. And it isn't going to be a perfect fix.
No.
But it will be better, no matter what we do to it, it will be better than it currently is. Because
right.
it's going to get us, it's already getting children in trouble, and families in trouble, parents in trouble, and it's going to get the taxpayer in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. Well, and then we have children, who are not with their families. We have traumatized parents.
Absolutely.
People afraid to parent. Now, this is, if we have just a few minutes, one of the questions I had, because working in domestic violence, I worked a lot with survivors and parents whose kids were experiencing domestic violence. So they're very nervous about the Department of Children and Families getting involved, hearing all these rumors. And so I heard over and over again that, I don't dare touch my kids. I don't dare spank them or anything like that, because if DCF gets called, maybe they knew better than I did, where this legally without defense,
right.
where they may end up. Even though I would try, let them know, well, legally you are allowed, right? We are allowed to spank. There's corporal punishment.
Right.
Is it allowed to a point? And so we're letting kids also not get disciplined. So we're in this sort of situation where there's this hands-off parenting.
Absolutely,
going on.
Yes.
And if I could just read this one example, number 15 from your report, this took 14 months for the case to resolve, and it was overturned in the end. The parent was alleged to have failed to intervene when the child was spanked by another parent. So the child was spanked, another parent didn't intervene, but this was after the child had set the fifth indoor fire in their home. So the substantiation was overturned by review due to the corporal punishment alone not being a basis for substantiation. I just thought that was an interesting case. And so, we do have cases where children are more and more and more, and teenagers especially, getting sort of out of control. They're becoming very hard to handle in today's media world and everything.
Yeah, and it is unfortunate but it's human nature. We undoubtedly have people listening to this program who could say, my child said that if I didn't do X, they were going to call DCF.
Yeah, you hear that.
And at the same time, we want to know when children are at risk. We want to know at serious risk. We want to know when they're being abused or neglected. The system we have just doesn't do that today.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets reported, and so abuse and neglect almost mean nothing anymore, because it can be anything.
Right, like falling asleep in a car was one of the cases this one that you
listed.
Yes,
exactly.
A pregnant woman falling asleep who has a young child. I mean, I would imagine she could fall asleep anywhere.
Well,
and that's not her fault.
And that instance, all that needed to happen was that the investigator needed to just take the next step over and mm-hmm. say, okay, did any of the things that were alleged, were they real? Were there people who saw it?
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out there weren't. And it's described as, on a hot summer day, the windows are rolled up, the person's passed out in the seat, the child is in the back seat crying and stuff. Well, no, they were parked under a tree.
Mm-hmm.
The windows were rolled up because the air conditioner was on.
Ah.
The person who was asleep was 8.5 months pregnant. The child who had been crying was teething.
Crying, yeah.
And the other parent had gone in to get ice pops for the child who was teething.
Right. Beautiful situation, really, when you look at it another way.
The way it was written up, this all of these terrible things happened, and there was not a shred of evidence to say that any of the original charges were true.
Wow. And so then the system's wasting their time on things like this.
Yes.
You know.
It does. There's a huge amount of time wasted. And again, it goes both ways because because we want investigations to be good.
Right.
We want them to be thorough. We just have to figure out in the state, how do you do that? And that's the challenge, because if the investigator doesn't make a decision quickly and something happens to the child, it's a tragedy.
Right.
At the same time, when the investigator makes a decision quickly based on partial information, their feeling is they give it to the court, let the court figure it out. Well, the reality is the court process is incredibly cumbersome and delayed. So it can take months and months and months for you, if you have a good advocate in court, to actually explain to the judge what's alleged never happened, and here's the proof it never happened. And they say, oh, okay, there are no merits to the case. This child should go back to the family.
But
3 months, 4 months, 6 months have passed. Even though the statutes say that it should have happened within a matter of days, that there should have been that kind of hearing.
Right.
Well, we have to adjust our systems to make them work properly.
Yeah.
And again, the fewer families we push into family court, the faster the family court can actually deal with the cases that really need to be dealt with.
That's true.
And the faster the service system can provide services to those families who really need it.
Mm-hmm.
The other families, why are we taking them to court?
Yeah.
You know, and why are we substantiating things based on no evidence? And I was in a discussion not long ago where someone said, well, the supervisors can take care of this at DCF. No, the supervisors sign off on these agreements. They sign off on the substantiations because they base their decision on what the investigator tells them.
Right. They're sort of just seeing this one little spot of it.
And then to take it the next step, that same information goes to a state's attorney for family court. The state's attorney has no way to verify whether the DCF information is correct. So everyone is sort of relying on someone else to be the check and balance, but there is no someone else.
Right.
And when all of this comes to light, there really is no entity that one can go to with, say, this report who can come down and say, okay, here's how we're going to fix this system. And that's why we have to go to the legislature. And I will say I very much appreciate the opportunity to present this information today. And I hope that people will, you know, go again to the website for the Vermont Parent Representation Center.
VTRPC.
And it's www.vtprc.org. And you will see the two different reports that are posted there. Bending the Curve, which is the first report on the whole system, and Broken System, Broken Promises, which is this particular report.
Wow.
And thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much for writing this, helping to write this report and bringing it together.
I had hoped we would have a different outcome in this report, but we didn't. And
well,
I'm just happy that we have the information now to present to the legislature, to the public, to the governor, to DCF.
Yeah.
And because everybody is trying to do a good job here with a bad system.
Right. And this is bringing justice and healing to people and empowerment. I think just bringing this to light to all the people who have been suffering all this time.
And that's what I hear from folks.
Yeah, and silenced and all that.
And I also want to thank the families that put their trust in this little nonprofit to actually represent them in these, you know, in these appeals, because they didn't have to do this. You know, they didn't have to go out on a limb. And we've asked a lot of them in this process to make sure we have all of the information. And, you know, they have done a real service, I think, to the state of Vermont.
To all Vermonters.
So
thank you all for your courage, everyone. And keep us in the loop into how we can help.
Absolutely.
If you need us at the State House advocating with you on certain days, you know, you let us know.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, take care. Well, we've been talking with Larry Crist, and from Broken Promises, Broken Systems is the new report that just came out a few months ago. You can find it at his website. Thank you for joining me for the 4-H show. Our next programmer is in the house. He will be with you with some amazing music in just a moment. And love and blessings to all the families of Vermont in this Thanksgiving season. I hope you're having a great one. Thanks for listening.